Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
So I met today's guest back in November when we were both invited to participate in a workshop and discussion for the National Association of Women in Construction, and Sharla had already done quite a bit of work with this group, and I thought Sharla Smith had a really powerful story. So Sharla, perhaps you'd like to say something about yourself before we start with a few questions.
Yes, so hello, my name is Sharla Smith. I am a equality, diversity and inclusion consultant. I work freelance actually for a few different organisations, and I facilitate sessions on unconscious bias, inclusive leadership and anti-racism. They're just a few. Sometimes I also design sessions dependent on what organisations want, what they feel that they need. Yes, I started off as a theatre actress, but I'm sure we're going to get to that a bit later, and fell into this role actually by the cosmos. And I'm loving it, and I'm loving the space, I'm loving the work. I feel like impact is happening, maybe not as fast as a lot of people want it to, but I do feel like my role has purpose and is definitely in the right place for change.
Brilliant. Hello, Sharla. Very nice
Hi.
To meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So you started performing arts at college and started adulthood wanting to be an actor. What inspired you to pursue a career in the creative industries?
So I think that I actually wanted to be an actor as a child. When I was reflecting, I was thinking about primary school, and at my primary school, you got to learn an instrument. They were very big on end of year performances. And it was at that point that my family knew that I quite enjoyed being sent a stage and heard. So I think that it started there. I always wanted to be involved in that. And I remember we performed a version of Bugsy Malone. And then I watched Bugsy Malone on television, like at Christmas, and I must have been around 9 or 10. Fell in love with Jodie Foster, the Tallulah character, and just started to watch everything Jodie Foster was in. And then I found I was a big Michael Jackson fan. My family, my cousins and I would create dances and songs and perform them at Christmas to our family, and they'd be heavily inspired by Michael Jackson. And a film came out called American Dream about Michael Jackson's life, and Angela Bassett played Michael Jackson's mum. So I reflect on this now because Jodie Foster and Angela Bassett, the types of roles that they've both consciously decided to do, had a great impact on me. And I think that as a child, I was like, I want to be an actress. But really what it was is that I wanted to be a woman that used my voice for change. And I can see that even when I kind of reflect on Angela Bassett and Jodie Foster.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So did all of that live up to your expectations?
In the acting sense?
Yeah.
It didn't live up to my expectations, which is why I'm no longer a theatre actress. There's a lot of barriers to jump over in the acting world that I wasn't really aware of, even though people would say how difficult it is and how challenging it would be. I didn't understand what difficult and challenging meant. I just wanted to do it. It was my dream. And no one in my family, like the adults, are actresses or writers or a part of media in any way. So I'm that first person. So it was very difficult and it didn't live up to my expectations. And I say that in hindsight, when I was in it, I wasn't really thinking that way. I was just thinking, how am I going to get my next job?
Mm. Yeah. So perhaps we can think a bit about why that was, because, of course, acting is one of those careers which has been heavily criticised for not doing enough to address racism. Was that something that you encountered?
Yes, but not in an overt way, in a right. covert way. And I think that because I was saying to Naomi that because of the family that I come from, and my family are Jamaican British, is how I would classify my heritage. I was brought up with celebrating that. And why I mention that now is because at some point I decided that I was going to get dreadlocks, and I was obviously told to not do that because of typecast and limiting the types of roles that I would then be put up for. But actually the opposite happened. What that meant was the types of plays I would audition for looked at race head on, questioned some of the biases that we all hold. And also, because of the dreadlocks, I was part of like a lot of new writing by Black women, and had expectations there that weren't met because of how intrinsic and ingrained racism is. So all of that. But again, I mean, there was one story that I can remember. I was doing a play that was set in Jamaica, and a director, we kind of was just having a break, and a director asked me, do I wash my hair with shampoo? That's the most kind of overt racism I can think of. And but yeah, a lot of the things that I've gone through have been very covert, very like not clearly an attack of oppression. But because of the field I'm in now, when I reflect, I can see what's kind of happening and going on.
Well, that's very interesting where you've described it as being covert rather than overt. It reminds me of when we spoke to Abdullah Mia some time ago, actually, one of our earliest podcasts, and he was working in the prison service, and he described how he always had to be on the alert. You know, he couldn't just do his job, which was leading a team, but he had to be, part of his mental energy was in monitoring what was going on around him, because he had to be on the alert.
This is interesting to me, especially because of what I do now. So I've chosen to put myself in a role in a position where I'm talking about race quite a lot. And even before I got this position, because of my mum did like a social policy degree when I was 14, 15, and a lot of her reading was like Oprah Winfrey's biography, Alice Walker, Colour Purple, a lot of Black feminists writing. And I was exposed to that, which means that I would go in spaces and celebrate my Blackness in a way that I recognize and actually understand that not every Black person of color wants to do. It's this conversation around I'm not a Black writer, I'm a writer that happens to be Black, where I would be like, I'm Black and a writer. I'm celebrating the Blackness. I want to turn that terminology around. So I guess dependent on who you are, the type of family you come from, it's whether or not you want to always talk about your race, your culture, your heritage.
Thank you. Yeah. Are there some areas of the performing arts which are more inclusive than others?
So I'm a theatre actress and I'm going to stay in my lane because when it comes to like media forms like TV and cartoons and stuff like that, I'm an audience member and I'm observing from that perspective. When it comes to theatre acting, I've got a bit of an inside perspective because that's the kind of, that was the field I was in. And so when I was thinking about this question, I was thinking about the networking spaces. So the times that actors get together when they're not on stage or they're networking to do a performance, but when they're kind of in between gigs and going to see somebody else at the theatre or just hanging out, the hanging out spaces, and how exclusive for me personally, how incredibly exclusive I found those spaces. And what would happen a lot of the time would be people would see a well-known director of a well-known writer and be talking to you to look busy, but really their eye is on that director or writer. So what that meant is you're in a space and you realize quite quickly that you're being spoken to only to fill in a gap, because really it's about what your status is, not about the genuine conversation and what you potentially can just naturally give that person through communication. And I hated that space. I hated the fact that people would... I was in a play and it did really well, and people would come up to me and congratulate me, and I got a lot of attention because I just got off stage. But I've also been in a position where no one doesn't know that I'm an actor and I'm there. And I would have met someone 100 times before, but they're not interested in talking to me at this particular time because they've got their eye on someone that can enhance their career. So it's incredibly exclusive industry, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Yeah, so it sounds quite challenging to work in. I was also thinking, Shara, about the fact that the public often have difficulty discerning the roles that actors are playing from real life, don't they? I mean, I don't know if you remember Coronation Street, and there was a campaign to free Deirdre Barlow. So there's something about the public sometimes really engaging with parts and roles in a way that takes it beyond fantasy. Mm-hmm. But they also often have quite rigid ideas about what characters from books or films or film remakes should look like, don't they? Mm-hmm. Is this something that you saw in the theatre as well?
I feel like in this regard, TV is a lot more rigid than theatre. Because before the dreadlocks, I was doing a lot of children's theatre. So I'd play children characters that you're just a child. And so that was an amazing experience because I recognised the role modelling I am having on the children coming to watch the play. And at the time, I had a niece who was young as well, and she would come and watch a lot of the performances I was in. So although there's always room to improve when it comes to like racial diversity in the theatre, I think that the theatre is a bit ahead of the rigidness of TV. I feel like TV have to be a lot more specific. And so I will talk about TV as an audience, from an audience perspective. I feel like a lot of historical stories have been whitewashed. I think that that's harmful because then you've got a generation of people who don't realise that, regardless of what their race may be. And then there's protests when that is changed. Because what do you mean, like the Free Deirdre? What do you mean? Anne Boleyn's a real historical figure, but we saw the reaction when Anne Boleyn was not played by someone of European descent. Or like James Bond is another one. This is a fictional character, and we saw that. And I understand all of that because of how we've all been programmed, very rigid, which makes me think about the whole casting process and who's in the room to do casting and the types of biases casting directors might have. Casting as a word, I mean, obviously there's the cast and we know the history of putting on character, but also there's the whole skin colour cast as well, which I often think about. And if I'm a casting director that hasn't had training on unconscious bias, I'm unaware of my biases. Who do I actually put up for the role? Who do I let get through the door to be in that kind of final five? I think that holds a lot of weight as well, the casting process.
Yeah, it sounds like the media could end up really distorting our ideas about the historical visibility of people who aren't white or straight or able and the kind of roles that it's okay for them to play.
I think that they can and they do and they have. Yeah.
Yeah. But the public doesn't get to see that often enough, do they?
I mean, things are... The internet is an interesting development, I think, when we talk about media. But because of the Coronation Street reference, back in the day, you're looking to TV to kind of teach you about different communities and different cultures. And so it holds so much weight if you are geographically located in one area of the country where you don't see racial diversity or you don't see other forms of diversity. You're heavily reliant on the news, on programs like Crime Watch, how people are depicted in soaps, to determine, is this good, is this bad, is this criminal, is this beautiful? And so it holds so much weight. And a lot of the work that I do and a lot of the conversations that I have, I can see generationally how it has changed because of platforms like social media and YouTube and all of that stuff. Although algorithms probably will start to recreate that kind of boxed view of, oh, I'm only going to feed you what you've kind of typed in. I'm not going to diversify your experience. So we'll see the effects of that in years to come.
Yeah, I think it'd be really interesting to see what happens with that, because it does offer some scope for alternative voices to be heard than what we're perhaps ordinarily exposed to. But for any actor, it must feel quite rejecting to audition for jobs that you don't get. And how did you cope with this?
Ultimately, I coped by asking myself some deep questions about whether it was the field I wanted to stay in. I think it caused a lot of mental health issues that I wasn't aware of until after the fact, because when you're in it and you just want the job. Mm-hmm. It's a problematic thing, but a tactical thing, in my opinion. And what I mean by that is, if I'm auditioning for a job, and not booking, what that means is I'm very much reliant on the support system I've got. And then I might be offered something that goes against my integrity, my values and my morals. But this support system that's had my back for years and years, I owe them something. And I'm going to take the job and treat it like a job. So it puts the rejection does something to your psyche to where now you have got the role. You feel like you've completely won and you don't want to ask any challenging questions. You just want to take it because there's an opportunity to explore your creativity and make some income. You know, that's what it kind of does. And I don't know whether the average actor kind of goes through that kind of journey because they're in it. But now that I'm not in it and I reflect, I can see how it affects my integrity and my voice, because I didn't feel empowered to say no, actually that doesn't align with my values, and I don't want to tell that story because it's not going to have a constructive result on the audience. It's going to actually damage how they perceive me.
It's quite an interesting observation, I think, because my guess is there's probably lots of people in other industries that might actually feel they're not aligned morally with the roles that they're taking, and may work in an industry or sector that they're not happy about, or feel some sense of discomfort at what's happening. But at the end of the day, we all need to work, don't we? But I can hear that there's a strong sense, you know, your integrity matters to you. Sounds like something you'll defend in a way that perhaps other people maybe allow that to take less prominence for them, or become a bit dislocated from it, or are in more desperate circumstances. But you've ended up moving into work in diversity, equality and inclusion, haven't you? I wondered if you could tell us something about how that move happened.
Through acting. It happened through acting. But just to go back a bit, with acting and creative fields like that, they make you feel like you can explore your value system. So then to then come to terms with the fact that actually they're saying that you can explore and they want to hear your perspective, but it's not really treated with high esteem, can be quite difficult to fathom. So I just want to say that, because it is a creative industry, so you're encouraged almost to then kind of have your voice, but a lot of the time it's not heard. So how I transitioned from being a theatre actress to a diversity, inclusion and equality consultant is because I was doing role play for an organisation. So sometimes what happens in training sessions is we may hire actors to act out behaviours that we want to change. And with a few organisations, we use forum theatre to do that. And forum theatre, also known as Theatre of the Oppressed, is a way for a group of nurses, say, to look at behaviour that might be happening in their environment and have input into changing that type of behaviour. So giving them real skills practice on how they can maybe approach their managers and stuff like that. So I was hired as an actor to do this, and then realised this whole space of training sessions and loved it, and actually was speaking too much in sessions. They'd only hired me to play a character, but here I was, you know, holding massive discussions around inclusive leadership or my experience as a patient. And so I spoke to that organization about my passion for actually facilitating. And, you know, I'd had experience doing drama classes for children, and I'd worked in sales, and there's other things as well, which I think made me attracted to this. And they were sure, you can facilitate, we'll train you up. And that's what happened. They trained me up, and I started to do this work. But Naomi, I remember when we were talking, there was also a point when I was doing the role play and playing the characters where basically there's this game that we play. And I basically had to stand in space, stand in the space neutral. And the participants were invited to say words of how they found me. And words like, oh, she looks really aggressive and really bossy and stern. And all of these kind of negative words started to come up. I was just told to stand neutrally in space. And that had a really big effect on me, because I wasn't aware that that's how I was coming across. And in my mind, I was just obeying the neutral direction that I was given. And I didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to stand in space, not be able to speak. And I didn't feel like the facilitator addressed or dealt with that the way I would have, because that, in essence, is unconscious bias, you know, because as well, the character was a leader, and I was trying to portray that even though I was standing in the space neutrally, that caused words like aggression to come out. And it made me think about how, you know, if you're a woman, if you're a black person with confidence, assertive, how that can sometimes be misinterpreted as aggressive, and I wanted to explore that as a career.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it seems to me it's always a two-way process. So it's not just, or may not be at all about what you're thinking or feeling, but it's mm-hmm. what people project onto you. And I guess that's the sort of thing you work with.
Yeah, that was the first time I was privy to hear what people thought about me. And that was about me. That wasn't about the character I was playing. That was about me standing in that space, you know. And then you think of, I just wanted to be an actor to tell people's stories, but people can't get past the fact of black and woman. And so through that lens is how I tell the story. And I want to be in control of that so that I don't reaffirm this kind of idea of overly strong, aggressive, or ugly. I want to be more in control of that.
I was wondering about what emotional impact that had on you, and also what support was given to you to cope with that, because that's quite a lot to take on, isn't it?
Yes. It was a lot, to the point where I didn't want to do it. So it was like, you know, I'm willing to step down on a job, which again, we all kind of need money to survive. It did have a negative impact on my well-being. But again, I come from a family who like celebrate where they come from and their culture. And I don't think I appreciate how important it is just to vent to my mum. You know, I think that's kind of how I gained support. I remember being in a production. The lead actress had to abandon the project because somebody in her family had passed away. So they asked if I wanted to do it. And I had to learn a whole play in a week. And I was broken. And I was crying on the floor to my mum. I mean, in the bath, on the bus, I had to just be going through lines because I had to learn this whole play. And I broke down. I was on the floor. But my mum was there, and she was just like, this is what you wanted to do. Go for it. Just do your best. That's all you're ever asked to do, is your best. And that similar advice was given in this moment. Just do your best. You want to have an impact on the world. You don't. It's never. No one told you it was going to be easy. All that's asked is that you do your best. But in terms of the organisation that employed me, I don't think that those things are thought about, because I'm living this experience. And there might be some access points, you know, if you have your own like marginalized experience that help you to understand my experience. But each experience is so nuanced and individual. I had to really understand this is my experience and the pain I feel. The organisation has no idea that I'm feeling it. And so this is why I've shifted into becoming a consultant and a facilitator. And man, has it cost me jobs, because even like DEI companies feel some type of way about being challenged. And I'm not saying that I'm always right. I'm just saying that I'm communicating my perspective just so that you know. And a lot of the times people say they want to hear that, but it's uncomfortable news. And, you know, everything's like this, especially inside of London. Quick, 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 quick. You're actually slowing down the process, Sharla. We just want to do it this way, you know. So
I think you highlighted something really important there around resilience, and that how much resilience gets located within the individual, you know. So it's your mm-hmm. vulnerability that needs to be, you need to go away and find a way to sort that, or you can go to this organisation or this person to get some support, rather than thinking about what it is about how the organisation works, which actually might mean that that puts additional stresses on people.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that it's why I've chosen to be freelance.
I was thinking while you're talking, Charlotte, it's really interesting because we've talked to many people, anthropologists, barristers, lawyers, who've got to a point in their work, in their careers, when they've realised they really do need to talk to someone. They need to talk to someone to unload and to help them process the kind of stuff they've been going through. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you're dead lucky because you've got and had your mum.
Yeah. And loads of therapy. And loads of therapy. I will continue to have therapy until my time here is up. Loads of therapy. And I feel like I've used my friends. I've forced them to listen to what I've got to say. Not so much now, but if I couldn't talk and communicate and write stuff down.
Yeah, well, you put it very well there.
Yeah.
So tell us, what kind of work do you do and with what kind of businesses do you do it?
So I do a lot of work in the public sector, and they are sometimes they're one-off sessions, training sessions. They might be just an introduction to diversity. Sometimes it's a whole course. So a medical organization might say, we want to book 6 classes and we want you to take us through unconscious bias, a bit of anti-racism and inclusive leadership. So it works as a kind of journey through. I don't do a lot of one-to-one coaching. I have done, but not so much. It's more, you know, sessions online. I really love the sessions in person. And because of the acting background, I try and make sure that I have, like, exercises and games and different interactive ways to engage people so they're truly engaging with the work and with the content. And also embedded in each session is legislation around the Equality Act, the protected characteristics, and statistics of why diversity matters.
So that's interesting. So, I mean, I hear what you say about preferring to do kind of real live work rather than online work, because I think we all get totally brassed off with online work. But how do you make it interesting? Because as we're just saying, everyone has had loads and loads these days, loads and loads of training. And yeah. So it can all become rather jaded. Does your former career, your acting career, help you to liven up your sessions?
I would like to think so. I was reading some feedback, and I get quite good feedback, but this was not so good feedback. And someone said, she clearly misses the stage. She was just like, she was on stage the whole time. And I sat back and reflected on that. I like to think that my sessions are engaging because of that piece of feedback, because I think that all feedback is amazing for me being the best version of myself, like Mummy said. So from that feedback, I kind of make a joke that, you know, I am going to present X amount of slides, we're going to go through data, all of that stuff, but there's discussion points. So I do my small groups, get them to really discuss how their organization looks, some microaggressions they may have experienced, and then we come back, we unpick it, we talk about it, we try and have truthful conversations in that space, set up by, you know, trying to nurture psychological safety, trying to nurture respect, but wanting frank conversations that actually happen. One of the things that I say in sessions is the more you put into this session, the more you get out. So I understand that your emails may be going off. I understand that you might want to be somewhere else, that you didn't choose to be here. It's mandatory. But the more you put into the session, the more you get out of the session. So I don't want to waste anyone's time. I don't want anyone wasting my time. Let's use this time to really have honest conversations. And I feel like that in itself helps. one of the things, one of the exercises I use often is what's hot and what's not. What's hot, what's been great about your day so far, and what's not been so great about your day. And what that does, that allows people to engage with their prefrontal neocortex. And what I say is, when you engage with what irritated you in the morning, like that person that barged you on the train, you go, oh, that's why I feel the way I feel. I'm off the train now, so I can let it go. So I invite them to kind of engage with those moments, which I also think helps to get people in the room, in the space, talking, and again, engaging with that prefrontal neocortex.
So to use your own question on yourself, Sharla, what's been hot and what's been about,
about my career? Day. About my career? Yeah. What's been hot about my career is when I was 8 years old, I said to my mum, dad and stepdad, I want to be an actor. And I became an actor. Did it. Tick. What's not been hot about my career in acting is that I got injured. And I realized quite quickly that more than being an actor, I wanted to be healthy and I wanted to have a real impact. So as diversity, inclusion and equality consultant, what's hot is that I get to design sessions and go into a space, meet different people, hear their different viewpoints and try and help and assist their experiences at work. What's not hot is ever so often, someone might throw something in a session that can be quite triggering. So I have to make sure I do all of this outside work to ensure that I react professionally should that trigger happen. And that's not even a knot. I think that in all forms of roles that we do as humans, I was saying to my mum, my mum's starting a new job, and I'm saying, before you have to go out there in the cold 9 to 5, you have to make sure that you're getting up now, having a walk now, exercising that mindset so that when it comes, it's not such a drag, it's not so exhausting because you've mentally prepared. So I'm really passionate about that. I'm really passionate about keeping fit, and not just my body, but my mind, so that in the sessions, if somebody says something that's quite discriminative, quite offensive, I can respond in a logical, reasonable way. Yeah.
Thank you. I think you kind of beat us to our last question, which we usually like to know. We usually like to ask people about how they keep themselves nourished, and you could hear that, you know, the real joy, you could see the joy on your face actually, and hear it in your voice as you spoke about what's hot about the career, but also good to have some words of wisdom about how to keep going even when things are challenging.
So may I use an analogy? So, you know, when you're playing tennis, I don't play tennis, but I just think this is a good analogy. And you're having to kind of get under the ball to hit the ball away. If the balls are like balls of oppression, stressful moments, life, I want to be able to get under the ball and be ready to hit it over. Under this way, over. And that requires me to be flexible and fit, and not just physically, even though the analogy is physical, but psychologically. You know, the exercise of the mind is a really important thing. And that would be my advice, you know, the well-being of the mind, the flexibility of that, because life throws things at us all the time. That is kind of its purpose. So what can we do to be prepared the most that we can, the best that we can, for when life throws that ball over? How can we prepare for that? That would be my...
It's a lovely metaphor. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Lovely to meet you, Sharla. Thanks very
lovely
much.
Lovely to meet you as well. Thank you. Thank you for having me, both of you.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Take care.